supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, you may call them cantaloupes, the supermarket may call them cantaloupes, but I'll bet you dollars to donuts they are actually muskmelons. We will tell you about the different varieties of tropical melons and, more importantly, what they need to grow. Later in the show, we will also talk with Linda Chalker Scott, author of the new book, How Plants Work, the science behind the amazing things that plants do. It's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dave, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Dave from Chicago, and I have an interesting fungus question for you.
Okay. Well, we're always very interested in fungus here in You Bet Your Garden.
Last fall, I got your compost book, and I set up three bins of shredded fall leaves, and the other day I was proudly showing my friend around the garden, and I noticed that on top of one of the bins, I had this bright yellow growth, and at first, I thought someone had sprayed the expanding foam sealant
right.
used for insulation on top of it. But then I realized that it was actually alive. So what is it?
Now, you said you built a three-bin system, but you just filled up all the bins. You're not using it the traditional way of filling the first bin with raw material, turning it into the second, and then turning it into the third where it becomes finished compost.
Correct. Each one is full. Well, now they've reduced in height by about half.
But good.
All they have is shredded fall leaves and coffee grounds.
Okay.
And possibly whatever's fallen from the apple tree right above this particular bin.
Ooh. Well, that's interesting. Okay. So what are the bins made out of?
They're made out of hardware cloth. I just got rolls of, 3 foot
by 10 foot. Good. Excellent.
Yeah.
So they're not wooden.
No.
Okay. Well, hardware cloth is a great choice. Hardware cloth is like the fencing with the world's smallest openings on it, and it's really great for airflow. So that was an excellent choice. And you say these shredded leaves are sitting underneath an apple tree. Does it bear?
Well, it's certainly seen better days. A lot of the trunk is covered with, I guess it's black scale. It's not in great shape.
So it's not a. Did it bloom well for you this spring?
It did, yeah. This year it bloomed very well, and it does look like it's setting fruit. So,
and
I did a lot of pruning this year on it.
Oh, good. Good for you. And which bin is it in? Number one, two, or three?
This is the third one that I built over the course of about a month.
Okay.
And it's in a totally different part of the yard from the other two.
Oh, I see. And it's the only one under the tree?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. I believe that your compost is colonized by the famous dog barf fungus, which is a real thing. It's a real thing. You know, these researchers get bored, Dave. They have to come up with something to keep them awake in their labs. There are a lot of what are called nuisance molds that mostly sprout up in wood mulch. And one of them is called this. It looks like a doggy came and threw up on your mulch.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
And I believe it's related to the slime molds. But the dog barf fungus, more typically, will rise up out of wood. It is one of the ways that the environment breaks down wood. The wood is colonized by this fungus. The fungus absorbs nutrients from the wood. The fungus flourishes, as you've seen. In doing so, it takes nutrients from the wood, moves the wood along to becoming soil faster. So I've never seen this in my compost piles. I can tell you it's totally harmless, and what you should do is just get out there with a pitchfork. Or, they make these great aerator tools where you just dive
right.
them into the compost and wings come out and move it around. So you just want to get that fungus down in the middle. I would not be surprised if you find a couple branches or pieces of wood that came off the apple tree over winter.
Right.
and the fungus colonized them. Apple trees are very symbiotic with a lot of fungal organisms. You find some of the best edible mushrooms, morels, in the spring underneath old apple trees. So there's there is a great relationship between these nuisance mold fungal organisms. Nobody would call morels nuisance molds. But apple trees are famous for this. So it's perfectly normal. I think there's probably some wood that dropped in there. But just mix it up into the center of your pile. Maybe add some more coffee grounds. The nitrogen will cancel things out in there. But this is totally harmless. It's not a bad fungus at all. So just mix it in. It might even wind up making the compost more nutritious in the end.
That sounds great.
All right, Dave?
Beautiful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. That was a great question.
Cool.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Janet, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Where are you?
Jenkintown, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Janet in Jenkintown?
Help me figure out what to do about my downy white scale. It started out on my oak leaf hydrangea 2 years ago.
Right.
I found out that the Primex folks told me what it was, and they said to spray horticulture oil on it and clear out underneath. Last year, there wasn't very much of it. It was still around, so I repeated. This year, it's still not very much on my oak leaf hydrangea, but they're all over one of my blueberry bushes, which is close by.
Okay. For our listeners outside the area, Primex is a very nice independent garden center out in the Jenkintown area. Very nice place.
Yeah, they're good people.
So did you take them a sample leaf with this creature on it?
Yes.
And they said it was a scale named after a fabric softener.
They said white downy scale.
Okay. All right, let's back up. Let's talk about your hydrangeas. Are they mulched? Are they fed? Are they growing in or near a treated lawn?
They're in a section that's just been, it's nothing but shrubs and hostas and stuff like that. 2 years ago when I first got the problem, I realized that somebody had put like a heavy black plastic and then mulch on top of that.
Right.
And the plastic was still there, and like under the plastic was pretty horrible. So I had to like rip out all the black plastic and then let the mulch, you know, go into the actual ground.
Okay.
Where it could do some good. And I put new mulch on top. And this year I had some mulch with some compost.
Okay, good, good, good. Now, your blueberries, because you say the creatures have kind of moved over to your blueberries.
Right.
Now, are your blueberries mulched or fed?
I kind of skipped them last year.
Okay. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean you
normally... Right, so I let the old leaves, everybody's old leaves, hang out around the, over the roots, and then I raked away what was left in the spring. I've got tons of worms and pill bugs and all kinds of stuff breaking stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
But the ground was a bit compacted around that particular blueberry bush. I've got three blueberry bushes.
Mm-hmm.
The other two look fine. This one that I was a little neglectful of is the one that has scale all over it.
And this is the time of year where we expect to see baby blueberries.
Yeah, they're like, you know, half grown already.
Oh, okay.
I've got a nice crop happening here.
Okay. What have you done to keep their soil highly acidic?
Well, I started adding coffee grounds.
Oh, okay. Well, that's okay. There's some discussion right now whether coffee grounds are highly acidic, but we know they're very rich in nitrogen. I think what your blueberries need is a mulch of milled peat moss.
Okay.
Covered by some compost, and if you wanted to go the extra mile, because blueberries need a highly acidic soil. They need the most acidic soil of anything we grow. What I would suggest is you do that, and you might want to go out and get an organic fertilizer that's also an acidifier, like Hollytone. You know, that's the big brand, but there's others out there.
Oh, I did them with fish emulsion this spring.
Well, again, that's all nitrogen. You're not giving them what they want. Blueberries in the wild. Blueberries are a Native American crop. They grow naturally in peat bogs. up north. Okay. So they really need a highly acidic soil, and they like a naturally rich soil. Fish emulsion alone, too, has some problems. The major brand that's been out there for years has a lot of chlorine in it for some reason. I certainly don't recommend it. I don't use it. So here's what I'm going to suggest. First, give the blueberries what they need, which is, you know, peat moss and compost and maybe a natural acid fertilizer. And then what I want you to do is the next couple mornings, go out with a hose and a nozzle that you can set for a sharp stream and cradle the plants with one hand. See if you can blast these suckers off.
Okay.
Do that a couple of days in a row. It doesn't sound like these things are really glued to the plants. Have you pulled them off?
Yeah, you can pull them off.
Yeah. To me, they don't sound like what I consider scale. And believe it or not, in a situation like this, high-pressure streams of water are the best pesticide. But you really got to blast them off. You know, think of like a cartoon fire hose.
Thank you.
Good luck, Janet.
It's easy. Thanks.
All right. You take care.
All right. You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will head west to deliver the keynote address at the annual Native Plant and Sustainability Conference at the Phipps Conservatory and Botanic Garden in Pittsburgh on October 14th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the fruit that you've been calling cantaloupes and the science happening in your own backyard. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, you may call them cantaloupes, but I'm betting you've never eaten a cantaloupe. We'll tell you what it takes to grow true cantaloupe, as well as those misnamed melons, later on in the show. We'll also take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest, Linda Chalker-Scott, author of How Plants Work, The Science Behind the Amazing Things Plants Do, from Timber Press. The imprint actually says Timber Press Science for gardeners. And Linda joins us from the studios of KUOW in beautiful Seattle, Washington. Linda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
So is this a new imprint of Timber Press? Are they doing special series of books on gardening science?
They are. I'm not sure if this is the first one. I kind of doubt it, but I do know that they are doing other ones after this because I think gardeners more and more really would like to have the science behind the practices.
Now, you're an associate professor at Washington State University, Extension Urban Horticulturalist. What made you want to write a science book for gardeners? And it's a very approachable science book, I should say right away.
Well, thank you very much. I think it's because I give a lot of talks and have been doing that for a couple decades now. And often when I'd be talking about whatever topic it was, people would say, well, how does that work? And that doesn't really sound like what I was led to believe on what plants do. And so the more and more questions I got, the more I thought, you know, there needs to be a plant physiology book for gardeners. And I don't know if you've ever looked at a plant physiology textbook before, but it would probably put you to sleep. And it's not to say it's not great, interesting material, but it is so unapproachable if you're not a scientist. And I thought we need to get this to a level that makes sense to gardeners so they go outside in their garden and they can put this knowledge to work for them.
You virtually echo just about all of the advice I give people about trees. And I had to laugh because the first thing you talk about in the book, which really established your credentials with me, is you killed a tree by being an idiot, you know, which
that's right,
which is how we all learn how to garden. But tell your tree killing story.
Well, this is when I was getting my PhD in horticulture.
Oh, good. And, good.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah. And I was learning all of the typical things that one learned as a graduate student in plant sciences back in the 1980s. And we'd bought a house which had a lovely Japanese maple in the front yard. And we had to put up some steps to do a deck to get to our front door. We just had a lot of work to do around this tree. And, of course, we had to dig a lot of this root zone out. And we did, and kind of cursing the roots as we went because we had to take all these roots out. And put down timbers and pavers. And then guess what? That tree died the next year. And I asked one of my very favorite people in my department, you know, gee, Jim, what could have happened? And he was really angry at me. He said, well, what do you think's going to happen when you take away 75% of a tree's root zone and then you don't water it? And, you know, it really shocked me that I hadn't been smart enough to figure that out for myself because I was getting a degree in horticulture along with, my concentration was in plant physiology. So I was really supposed to know how plants work and how plants respond. And here I was dumbly doing something without really thinking about it.
So let's talk about some of the biggest mistakes that people make that are unfortunately very common. One of your side notes in the book is you talk about when you're dealing with how many plants. I mean, sometimes I feel stupid asking people if they saw a big tree or shrub that's now suffering, if they actually saw it being planted to try to establish if the wrappings had been taken off. And you have a great new test that I'm going to steal from you. I'll try to remember to give you credit, but memory is something that doesn't always work with me. And you say to wiggle the tree.
And, that's right.
And if the tree wiggles, that means its roots are still tucked up safe where nothing can hurt them.
That's right. Yeah, the wiggle test is a really easy way to tell what's going on underground without having to put a shovel into the ground.
And then you're an advocate of root spreading, which I don't necessarily talk about one way or the other, but I've always done it with roses. And sometimes I'm probably guilty of not spreading out container-grown plants' roots enough.
So it's really important to get those roots going out in all different directions horizontally because roots grow out more than they grow down. And so you want to get them all going out like spokes on a wheel to establish themselves in soil, which both supports the plant plus, you know, gives it access to water and nutrients. If they're left all bound up in a circle, especially if something's pot bound, They don't just suddenly straighten themselves out. They're pretty much in a perm, and they're going to stay curled and circling and just get bigger and fatter until they all just kind of fuse together into a big radish.
Another piece of advice where you and I are in total agreement, don't amend the soil in the hole. Now, you make a good argument for this, again, in much the same way. You want the roots to have to grow out into the surrounding soil. When I'm giving garden talks, I use the comparison, if you amend the soil in the planting hole, it's like your children graduate college and you put new plasma TVs into their bedroom.
No. I can tell you, maybe you should have written this book.
You want them to spread out into the cold, cruel world, which is lousy clay soil in the world of a tree.
That's right. Or, you know, compacted or whatever. And so what I tell people is yes, you want to have organic matter near your newly established tree, but put it on top. Don't put it inside.
Root flare. My good friend Howard Garrett down in Texas hammers this all the time. I hammer it. I was so pleased to see you hammer it. There are no trees in nature that I know of that look like lollipops. And when people hide the root flare, when they bury the tree too deeply, as you point out, you know, it's going to lead to an early death of the tree. Tell us as a scientist, what happens when you bury the root flare?
Well, what you've done is now covered up at least part of the bark on the trunk with soil in a nice, moist, dark environment, and pathogens just love that. And on the outside of the bark, there's what are called lenticels, which are little kind of air holes, for lack of a better term.
Say this again. What are they called?
Lenticels.
Okay.
Like lentils, but with a little bit of pencil at the end.
Mm-hmm. And they bring in air?
Yeah, they'll do gas exchange. And so that's how a lot of the gas gets exchanged, you know, in the trunk of a tree. And then if they're buried, those things are wide open, you know, trying to get air into these tissues that are now buried beneath the soil. And that's a great way for pathogens to get in as well.
And which leads us into another thing I took notes on in your book. And I think this is the most poorly understood by gardeners, the importance of air down at the root system.
Absolutely. People think that, you know, because plants make their own oxygen, which they do in their leaves, that they don't need to have oxygen around them. But the roots aren't photosynthetic, and they're just like we are. And what I tell people is when you're planting or putting down mulch or whatever, you know, think about that you're the one that's underneath all that. And what's going to be the easiest way for you to get oxygen? Is it being covered up by, you know, fabric and cardboard, or is it because or if you've got a nice chunky mulch that lets oxygen through?
And one of the other things you mention in the book that I was so pleased to see is everybody thinks of spring as planting time, and for long-lived plants, it's treacherous because you and I say exactly the same thing. Yes, it's spring. The soil is soaking wet, and searing summer heat is right around the corner.
That's right. And it's really difficult on plants to put the resources into root growth when they're busy putting out lots of leaves. So if you can kind of separate those two activities and wait until plants are dormant, plant them in the fall, mulch well so that you're not going to worry about freezing the soil underneath there, and let them have that entire winter when the soil isn't frozen to start to establish. And then by the time spring rolls around, they've got the roots to provide water and nutrients for good leaf output.
Is there anything we haven't covered, anything that you really want, hope for people to take away from your book?
You know, the big thing for me is just getting people excited about understanding how plants work. And, you know, that's the science part. And if I ever start, you know, using the science word, it tends to turn people off. But just saying, you know, aren't you curious about how this works? And just getting that sense of curiosity going for gardeners. And most gardeners have that anyway. You know, it's funny because we tend to think of plants as being less complicated because they don't do all the things animals do. They don't have a central nervous system. They can't move. There's all these things that make us think that they're just not as complicated. And especially the biochemistry of plants is so incredible. And you saw my chapter on that when I talk about how amazing it is, all these chemicals that plants make. And we don't even know what most of them are yet. That's the most amazing thing of all, is the untapped wealth of plant biochemicals.
Well, there is an untapped wealth of basic understanding about how plants work in your book, which is called How Plants Work. We've been talking with Linda Chalker Scott, author of the new book, How Plants Work, The Science Behind the Amazing Things Plants Do. It's brand new from Timber Press. Linda, thanks so much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. It was really a lot of fun.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marissa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Marissa. I hope you are well.
I am indeed.
And where is Marissa well?
Well, right now Marissa's in North Wales, but my question is actually specifically to do with the North Wales. My husband and I are buying our first house, and we'll be moving next week. I'm planning on building a raised bed, 8x4, about 20 inches high, and I've ordered some, you know, like premium garden soil from a local soil company. So my problem is I only need about a yard and a half, but I have to get 2 yards delivered. So my question is, what can I do with that extra half yard of what will be a compost and topsoil mix? Can I, you know, use it as a mulch? If not, you know, how could I store it so I can use it next year?
Do you hear all that noise in the background? That's all of your new neighbors going, I'll take some. I'll take some. Marissa, there is one firm rule of organic gardening. Nobody ever gets to August and wishes they had bought less compost. Nobody ever gets to August and wishes they had shredded fewer leaves the fall before. This stuff disappears like you won't believe. Now, I'm very impressed that you're building a bed 20 inches high. That's a nice, a deep level. Is that for your ease of use, or you had something that was 20 inches high laying around?
Well, it's a little bit for my ease of use, but also so that I can grow like carrots and stuff in the same bed. And I'm building it myself, and I'm pretty handy, so I just figured, you know, deeper was better in most cases.
Oh, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. You really can't grow carrots in a flat earth garden. And even a raised bed that's a foot tall, you know, some of the longer, more beautiful carrots really need some more root room than that. And you'll be able to grow great potatoes as well. My concern is you're not going to have this puppy ready until like July.
So, well, actually, I'm planning on building it the weekend that I move in, and I'm getting the soil delivered on the 8th. So I'm taking the day off from work just to focus entirely on building this bed. You know, at this point, I'm just so garden mad that I can't wait to get there. And, you know, I can't wait to indulge.
I love people who are buying their first house. First, congratulations. But second, you have no idea. Nothing works inside that house, Marissa. The electric is going to need work. The plumbing is messed up. You're going to find leaks. And Marissa's going to be outside. You know,
my husband's being very forgiving about this.
You're out of your mind, first of all.
I absolutely am, but yes. I really can't wait.
I understand. Now, here's what I suggest you do. First of all, you got to get the inside of the house together. But there is absolutely nothing wrong with you taking breaks, going outside for an hour in the morning or the evening when the weather is a little bit cooler and kinder, and knocking this thing together. My advice, especially if there's nice gardens around, go slowly with the raised bed. This pile of soil will disappear before you know it. You may wind up ordering more in the fall. If you want to go for the gold, and it sounds like you really respect the need for a light soil, a friable soil, get a big bag of perlite, P-E-R.
I actually have 2 bags of vermiculite ready to go basically as soon as the soil comes. So I read Square Foot Gardening and, you know, have been studying that extensively.
Okay. Mel and I disagree on the soil lightener. If you're going to use the vermiculite, I insist you use a dust mask.
Okay, I will do that.
There has been some issues with asbestos contamination, natural asbestos from the vermiculite mine. So be very cautious with that. I don't use it. I just use perlite. But mix that in as you go. Take your time, build your beds. If you have a huge amount of leftover soil, yes, absolutely just spread it as a nice light mulch around the existing landscape plants. No deeper than an inch or two and not touching the trunks, but it will make a very fine mulch. And my advice is not to try to rush things because you're not going to have a full growing season left. But what I would suggest is you get this thing built, you take your time, and you can certainly put out some bush beans that ripen up very quickly. You can.
Well, unfortunately, I abandoned hopes for tomatoes, but bush beans are definitely on the menu.
Exactly. Get them out there as soon as you can. If you haven't bought them already, buy the variety with the shortest days to maturity. Because they will really come in earlier than the other ones. And then be ready to go crazy with salad greens and carrots and beets and pansies and maybe dedicate a section of this raised bed to some garlic that you will grow over the winter. And then the final thing I'll say is when you build this box, maybe plan to have hoops going over the top of it that you can stretch a row cover fabric over top. Then you can probably grow salad greens all winter long through the spring, and you'll have really warm soil to plant in for next season.
Great. Well, thank you so much for all the advice. I can't wait to put it into action.
Good luck in your new home.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I hope the Pirates make the postseason this year, because I'm going to be in Pittsburgh to deliver the keynote address at the annual Native Plant and Sustainability Conference at the Phipps Conservatory and Botanic Garden on October 14th, primetime postseason time. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the fruits that you've been calling cantaloupes and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hard-working hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a few brief moments, as opposed to those agonizing long moments, we'll tell you the difference between a cantaloupe, a muskmelon, a honeydew, and why you've been using the wrong name all these years. We'll also take a couple more of your fabulous phone calls right after this.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Rich, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I am just ducky today, sir. How are you?
Very, very good. And a lot better if you can help me with my city tree.
What city is Rich's tree in?
In Philadelphia, beautiful center city. And part of the program that the city plants trees, they planted this January an American hornbeam right in front of our office.
Where in center city?
Queen Village, right up 2nd Street.
Now, you're the guy who sent me the email this morning.
Exactly.
You sent me an email of the tree, which was not very helpful to me,
okay,
except for the fact that this was a big tree. This was not a newly planted tree in my universe.
Yeah, well, I guess they must grow them somewhere in some greenery, and then they, you know, they put, but it did. It came in this January. That's the size they put it in.
But it's like a 20-year-old tree or something.
That's what they planted. And, you know, they cut the cement and they put it in and it was mulched. I gave it a tree spike fertilizer in early spring.
I wish you hadn't done that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, Rich.
Mm-hmm.
When we go walking through Fairmount Park and we see the trees, has nature come along and spiked them?
True.
Yeah, there are so many products out there, and if this is a commercial tree spike, it's full of chemical salts.
Oh.
Especially after this past winter, your soil was already salty enough in Center City. So, did you observe them planting it?
I did not.
But it's unlikely they would have left the wrap. I would have loved to have seen them install this thing. How tall is it?
It's definitely taller than me. It's got maybe like 6.5 feet. Yeah,
okay.
It is. I mean, it's a good, has a lot of growth to it, and but the leaves are just so struggling so much. All my coworkers make fun of me because I water it every night before I walk home.
Okay, that's bad.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
So here's the deal. Now, we don't know really what kind of situation it's in. You say they busted up the sidewalk.
Yes.
And drop this tree in. And
yeah,
if I remember correctly, there's not a lot of distance between the skirt of this tree and the cement?
Exactly right, no.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it seems like an overly large tree for the space. To me, they should have either put in a sapling or busted up twice as much cement. Now, what kind of mulch is around it?
It's what they put in it. They came back a month or so ago, and they put the mulch around it.
Okay. Did you remove the mulch at all?
I did not. No.
Okay, get it out of there. I believe, if I remember correctly, my wife is laughing insanely at home right now, that I could see part of the root flare.
Yes, it is sticking up a little, yes.
Good. So move all that mulch out of there.
Okay.
Your tree is in a very difficult situation. You don't want to be watering at night, and you don't want to be watering shallowly every day.
Oh.
What you want to do in the morning, mm-hmm, about twice a week, go out and make like 4 trips, and each trip drop like a quart of water,
okay,
around the roots of that tree. Then go back inside for a half an hour, let that water settle, come out and do it again, like until you've got a good gallon around,
okay,
it. Don't do this if we get rain. Deep but infrequent, and in the morning,
okay,
not at night. And if you want to give it a little bit of nutrition, go out and get a fish and seaweed mix, liquid fish and seaweed mix.
Wow.
And just put a little bit into that quart of water, like a couple of tablespoons.
Okay.
And then water it with that. That'll give it all the natural nutrients it needs. I would like to put some compost there, but we got no room for that.
Sure, no.
Keep the base of the tree open. Get rid of any mulch touching the trunk. Keep that root flare nice and visible.
Okay.
And give it some time and don't panic.
That's fantastic. And I will send you a picture when it's nice and thriving on the website.
Good, good. I'm tired of people sending me pictures of sick plants. All right, Rich.
All right. Thanks so much, Mike.
Take care, man.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Marianne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Marianne. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I am just ducky, thank you. And where is Marianne well?
I'm in Orange, Massachusetts.
So where are you in reference to Boston, which I guess is the only thing people understand in Massachusetts, right?
I'm about 2 hours outside of Boston.
Whoa, which way?
West.
What can we do for Marianne in Orange, Massachusetts?
I have a question about hoses. I have been very interested. I actually, in my garden, which I'm a fairly new gardener, just a few years now, I found finally a hose that is lead-free, that is for potable water. And I'm very interested in having a soaker hose or a drip irrigation, but I'm doing research, and everything that I see is made out of, you know, recycled tires or things that I think are pretty toxic. And I'm just wondering if you know of any drip irrigation or soaker hoses that are considered safer and actually for potable water that can be drunk by a human being.
Well,
I find it appalling that all these hoses that little children are playing in the sprinklers have lead and things in them.
And I'm sure the older people in the audience and my friend Al in the control room can remember drinking warm water from the hose on a summer day. And to say that it was a unique flavor that we would never experience again in life, luckily, lead just makes you a little less smart than, what was I saying? But, I mean, I am with you. A couple of years ago, I started to investigate garden hoses and started to replace my existing hoses with ones that were certified as safe for drinking water. I mean, it's a really easy out. And, you know, they're so much heavier than the other hoses, too. It's obvious they're made in a totally different manner. And I really like them. They work really well. They've held up brilliantly. They're very strong. And I'm much more comfortable about the water that comes out of them. If you've done this research and you can't find really cleanly made soaker hoses, which is a specialty, I would think your only choice would be to look for some of these drinking water safe hoses on sale and then lay them out on a driveway and very carefully, with some help, take an ice pick and heat it up with a lighter and just make a series of holes, like every 6 inches, on a line. And then it's very easy to buy a cap for the other end of the hose where you're, you know, your nozzle or whatever would normally go on.
I thought about that, but I have two concerns. One is that if enough water isn't allowed to get out, that the pressure could build up and the hose could burst. And my second concern is that perhaps I will be compromising the safety of the hose by puncturing it. You know, that there might be some inner lining that is safe for water, but if I poke a hole through, that it might be coming through something inside the hose.
Well, let's be honest. There's herbicides in our rainwater. There's only so much we can do. We live on a planet with a lot of pollution. You are trying to get to 100%, and now we're worried that you might only hit 95, as opposed to the alternative, which sounds more like a 15. So I would say go with the ethic of constant improvement. This is an expensive way to do it, but I think it would work very well. I doubt you would be compromising the hose. And the pressure, I don't think, is going to be an issue. You'll be able to control that to some degree by the distance between holes. If you find it's building pressure too much, just go back and make some extra holes so it's every 3 inches instead of every 6 inches, or just don't turn the faucet on as far. That's something that you'll be able to play with and work out.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for thinking so much about trying to have a clean environment around. You take care.
You as well. Thank you so much. Happy gardening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, which I have playfully titled, Is That a Cantaloupe in Your Pocket, or Is It a Muskmelon? Anyway, producer Alexis Landis, please read us this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. Chris writes, I have a flat earth plot in a community garden in Shawnee, Kansas. My 7-year-old son Jack loves cantaloupe, a.k.a. muskmelon, and demanded that we try to grow some this year, so the pressure is on me to deliver. I haven't tried to grow them before, but a couple of other gardeners have told me they haven't had any luck with them. Back around May 1st, we started some plants from seed under the lights I used to start tomatoes. Now what? A few websites say to use black plastic to keep the soil warm. Do you have any advice? P.S. Thanks for doing your show. I listen to the podcast as soon as they are available. I also liked your tomato book so much I bought a copy for my mom. This year I grew so many tomato plants I had enough to give away to 6 friends and family members. I would never have attempted anything that elaborate without you egging me on. Well, Mike, that's really sweet.
Oh, you got that right. 2 copies of my tomato book. Ka-ching, ka-ching. That's a cool $1.20 in royalties.
Nice to see that you're always thinking of the needs of others. Now, what about his cantaloupe plants? And why did he say, a.k.a. muskmelon?
Well, I think Chris already understands that the netted melons you see in supermarkets underneath signs that scream cantaloupe, you know, the melons with those raised lines or netting on their surface, are not cantaloupes of any kind, but muskmelons, a name that reflects their musky fragrance and flavor. The ones I see most often are Western muskmelons. Most of the varieties are round, some are a little more oblong, and all have orange flesh underneath a layer of green skin and a very heavy netting. Eastern muskmelons have a much finer netting, orange skin, and they're ribbed like pumpkins, sometimes dramatically so.
So do you ever see real cantaloupes, and what do they look like?
True cantaloupes are personified by the French Charente melons. They have no netting. Most have somewhat hard, kind of warty rinds. The classic varieties are light green with much darker green striping stem to stern on the outside, and their flesh is very aromatic, but perfumey as opposed to musky. They're said to be the best tasting of all melons, but you're going to have a hard time finding them. The only place you're likely to see them is at the occasional farmer's market.
That's what Chris should have grown.
No. His kid grew up liking the supermarket melons, so that's what he should try and grow. But we don't know what he actually has.
You don't think he started the seeds of a Western muskmelon?
It's really hard to say. In this wonderful world of mixed-up nomenclature, you're going to have a much better idea what you're growing by the specific variety name. There are very legitimate arguments over whether a certain melon is a musk, a cantaloupe, a honeydew, or some kind of hybrid, intentional or otherwise. Melons cross-breed as promiscuously as squash. And it's not like there's a basic one. I looked at the Burpee Seed Company catalog, which is a good example for this kind of thing, and they list 30 different tropical melon varieties, 7 of which appear to be kind of like the supermarket types, and some of them have the word cantaloupe in their variety name. Luckily for us, all of these melons need the same basic things. Full sun, warm soil, and a solid 75 to 90 days of real summer weather.
So in Shawnee, Kansas?
USDA Zone 6, a shorter season than we have here in Philly. But if he gets his transplants into the ground the first week or two of June, he should have some ripe melons by the time school starts up again. But he has to wait to plant until his nights are totally and reliably in the 50s. These are seriously tropical plants. And this year, I personally have had nights that dropped into the 30s late into May. He also needs to be very careful when he does plant. These melons don't take any movement around their roots.
I'm thinking he needs a raised bed for this.
Absolutely. Rich with the best quality compost he can find. This is also one of those rare instances where I do suggest covering most of the soil with black plastic to keep it warm. And I would also protect the young plants with floating row covers.
Oh, those light fabric blankets to keep insects off?
More to keep warm air trapped around the young plants early in the season. And I wouldn't remove those covers until every plant has several open flowers. Then you have to remove them to let pollinators in or you won't get any melons.
And then?
Well, once each plant has set a good number of fruits, you should pull off the lesser-looking ones until you have a maximum of 3 or 4 nice-looking melons per plant. Then you need to pull off any new flowers that form after that.
And how will he know when they're ripe?
Ooh, that's the master class. Unfortunately, the ripeness clues vary dramatically among the different types of melons. Read the seed packet, search the variety name online, and maybe light a candle to the Blessed Mother.
Couldn't hurt.
Well, that sure was some interesting information about the wild world of tropical melons, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to massacre my muskmelons if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email with your location. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore. With your location. At garden@whyy.org. Oh, and please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about where you are, but where you will find the answers to all your garden questions, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our perpetually popular podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY and could not say perpetually popular podcast if you paid her. Perpetually popular Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. She would have dropped off the edge at Perpetually. But you should still check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz keeps our website up and running. Amiable Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Affable Al Banks is our editor. We had great assistance this week from E-Man Ethan Samuel. I'm your host, maniacal Mike McGrath. Okay. When it came time for me to actually get my official credit line nickname at Marvel Comics back in the 70s, Stan christened me Mellow Mike McGrath. I think we can all agree that Stan the Man was wrong for once, and that I shall return to be even more maniacal next week. Avocados assemble! It's composting time! What can you expect to hear next week? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I have no idea what we're going to do. Only that it will be fun and that I will get into trouble. Plus your fabulous phone calls.